Conference record has joined the conference.
Myself and Paul Kessler began to study the approach to treating inherited muscle diseases. We really took a fairly broad view that one could use the concept of gene transfer as well as stem cell therapies for inherited muscle diseases. And that really was our very first proposal in this area to a local foundation in Maryland, which funded our initial work. And that led us to the finding that, at least initially, that we felt that we could demonstrate that it was possible to restore alpha-glucosidase activity in tissue culture cells. So the very first work was in vitro, as it's called, or in tissue culture, using an adenovirus to carry the gene for human alpha-glucosidase back into cells which were deficient in the protein. And this was very similar findings to what others had done in both using different types of viral vectors as well as in other disease areas. What was a departure for us was the work that was done with another kind of viral gene transfer agent called adeno-associated virus. This was actually another part of my background in my graduate training. I worked in a laboratory which studied Papova viruses, a related DNA virus that actually is more of a tumor virus, but also has many of the same properties of its life cycle as AAV. So this was a great opportunity to return to that very basic virology work that I had done. And in what we found with AAV was that it, when used as a vehicle for bringing genes back into cells, had an unusual property in muscle cells. And that was that the DNA, which was carried by the virus, actually lasted in the muscle cells for, as in the initial experiments, as long as we carried out those experiments, which were a year after the gene was transferred in mice. And that was a new finding in the field of gene therapy. There had not previously been any sustained gene transfer with the DNA virus that infected non-dividing cells, as was the case here. That initial work used a marker gene and was not a study done in Pompe's disease, but it was done as kind of to lay the foundation for what we hoped to do for alpha-glucosidase activity. And so that was the start of an area of investigation about gene transfer to muscle cells, which has really grown substantially over the years. That was in 96 that work was done, started early in 95. And so in the almost nearly 10 years that has elapsed, we've put a lot of effort into evaluating how AAV transduces muscle, how the transferred gene stays in muscle cells, and whether this approach would be feasible for children with Pompe's disease. That, you know, as a clinician caring for kids with inherited muscle diseases, and particularly that affect the heart, that's always been our goal, as to try to bring these basic science findings to the clinic. When I moved from Baltimore to Florida, it was with the intention that we would build a gene therapy center which was focused on what some people call translational research, and that is the kind of applied science which brings a basic investigations to the clinic. So our center has focused on that and invested in facilities which can make clinical material for human studies and as well provide the support necessary to follow through the regulatory process, which can get the approvals to conduct those clinical studies. So there's a multi-level approach to doing these studies, starting with the basic science and hopefully a good idea about how to proceed to attack a problem, designing the proof of concept studies that demonstrate the usefulness of a given approach, and then importantly, demonstrating that that approach is safe and effective, which are some of the criteria by which the FDA judges these studies, and then to bring them into the clinic with the preclinical science and the clinical science that's required to get these, if they want to call them drugs, to patients. And that's been what we've done here at Florida since 97 when I came. And so we've finally reached that goal in one disease model and in a form of inherited emphysema with a lot of help from the Alpha One Foundation. We have been able to start a phase one trial of a gene transfer into muscle, very much the same approach we anticipate using in Pompe's disease, for an inherited protein deficiency called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Three subjects have actually enrolled in the first trial, a safety study of AAV being made from muscle cells, and this has been the subject of a whole host of papers and grant proposals about that approach to treating alpha-1 deficiency, which is was right now treated by a drug called prolastin, which is an infused protein, much like is under study in the Pompe population. And that has gone well so far. There are a number of other areas where AAV is being intensely evaluated for other disease populations, including hemophilia, a host of eye diseases. There are almost 60 patients, subjects now in human studies that have been evaluated for gene transfer for cystic fibrosis into the lung. Several patients with a type of muscular dystrophy, limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, have been studied. So we're hoping to kind of continue this work, continue the study in the alpha-1 deficient patients with another type of AAV, which actually has been some very productive work by the group at University of Pennsylvania, who found additional types of AAV which were previously not known, and that those serotypes, they're called, of AAV are very efficient in gene transfer, and particularly into skeletal and heart muscle. So that's kind of the history. I'd be happy to answer questions about any specific aspects of that, from the basic science issues to the process of getting a program through the FDA into the clinic, and then how those are evaluated clinically for safety and efficacy.
Are you ready for questions?
Sure, sure. Okay. I mean, I could talk about any one of those specific areas, but of course, as in many of the things we do in science, when we answer one question, it raises two more questions. So we keep finding new things about this disease entity. Certainly, we feel like we've learned a lot from models that we have generated in close collaboration with Nita Rabin, back when we first started this work, we felt that was a critical component, and both our lab and Nina's lab collaborated together to make knockout constructs, which generated the mice that we use today to study gene transfer in Pompe's disease. And while they are not entirely predictive of what we would expect in human subjects, it's been very helpful to get a glimpse as to what might be expected after certain approaches to treatment of the disease.
Professor Byrne, my name is Mr. Giandani. I'm calling from North Jersey. From what you described in your comments, is it my understanding this is strictly for kids? You have any program for adults?
Well, the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency trial is actually only in adult subjects. The initial studies are aimed at looking at a single site of injection of AAV that would lead to secretion of the protein from that site and have a therapeutic effect in the rest of the body. This may be an approach which seems to work quite well in alpha-1 disease, had some success in hemophilia, and actually was our initial thought about how it might be approached in even adult or younger patients with Pompe's. I think the immunology of Pompe's disease is a little more complicated than these other diseases, maybe actually not too much different than hemophilia. One of the challenges we see to that approach, which is part of the challenge faced by infused protein therapies, is the production of antibodies against the protein. So one of the reasons we're focusing on the younger patient population is, one, we see less immune resistance to the protein when high levels are generated that are consistently made, and secondly, maybe that same effect would be not as great in adult patients with some protein that is really only partially defective. But right now, we felt like the most pressing medical need was in the infant population who would benefit from systemic gene transfer.
Thank you very much, Professor.
What's that?
Thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah, so adult patients are not off the list, but the approach that we're contemplating now, it actually would focus on the smallest kids first.
Okay. Dr. Byrne.
I have a question.
Yes.
I am from California. My name is Debbie Chan. I have a daughter who has the disorder. She's 13. And I would like to know how many more clinical trials that will be coming up for her age, and also how many more trials before the the drug can be on the market approved. I know it's a it's
sure.
A question everybody wants to know.
a general background on the notion of drug approval, whether they're protein drugs or gene drugs. There is a very long process which involves first establishing safety and then demonstrating from some critical what are called endpoints or outcomes of the treatment whether they are effective. And so it depends on what part of the disease one is addressing, which would influence what is on the label for so-called release or availability of the drug. And that's a very long process. And in fact, no gene therapy approaches to disease have been licensed or passed the final stage of testing, even to this date. So, but that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some benefit potentially from them in the process of evaluating their effectiveness. And one point I might raise about the older patient, particularly the in that age range of later childhood to early adulthood, since respiratory muscle weakness seems to be one of the predominant features of the disease in this population, one of the things we've contemplated, it's not on the docket immediately, but we've recently published a paper about gene transfer to the diaphragm, and that is a restricted muscle group which we feel would be very approachable by a gene transfer approach specifically to the diaphragm. And that improvement in diaphragm strength and function may be sufficient to ameliorate a lot of the symptoms in the older patient and avoid the potential for toxicities related to this approach.
I have a question.
Yeah.
My name is Debbie Walter. I have a 9-year-old son who's in the special access program. He's at UAB at Birmingham. We go every 2 weeks to have ERT. Will ERT be a requirement before they're allowed to come into clinical trials for the polymer gel?
No, that's a very good question. Sometimes clinical studies are designed to develop a clear-cut difference between one therapy over another. I think that gene transfer approaches actually have the, particularly for subjects who are already in clinical studies, have the potential to enhance these. And
our
initial feeling is that there would not necessarily need to be exclusive treatment with one approach or another if one can distinguish the effects of one approach apart from the other. And that's one of the challenges of looking at specific outcome measures. For example, if the question was related to the diaphragm and one had established a stable level of diaphragm function that was not changing and the treatment was focused on the diaphragm, for example, then it may be possible to see the effect of a treatment on the diaphragm even in the setting of receiving another therapy.
Especially like a child like mine and like so many that are on ERT that are vent dependent. You know,
right.
Because he's 24/7 and has been since 98.
And have you seen any change in the ventilator use in the current?
Not really, but we're very, very, very young into it. He's only on his 12th treatment. Now, we've seen a tremendous change in the heart, in his general health and well-being, you know, just that he feels better, because his heart involvement was pretty serious, and blood pressures have stabilized, but we haven't got as far as to see, you know, where we are with the ventilator yet.
I think you bring up an important point. You know, there was a lot of focus on categorizing the disease into different bins, if you will, of certain types of disease. And I think we now, when Dr. Rabin and I talk about this, we and other people in our team here feel pretty confident that we see what is a spectrum of disease, from very severe early onset disease to very mild late onset disease. It is tends to correlate with the degree of enzyme activity, but we also feel that there are other factors which influence the severity of the disease in different organ systems. So it used to be thought that a child as old as 9 actually didn't have any heart involvement related to the disease, but it's clear that that can be the case.
I have a question. My name's Jared Salbato. I'm from San Diego, California, and I have adult onset Pompe disease. Keep up with the literature very closely, and I've read a lot of your work. I'm just wondering, how is your approach unique to what Dr. Amal Sakana was? It looks like you are directly targeting muscle, and Dr. Amal Sakana is targeting liver. which leads to uptake by muscle. Do you see any particular advantage to targeting muscle directly?
Well, there are two different vectors in use in those studies that are directed at the liver. We had done some early proof of concept studies with adenoviruses, and it has generally been found in the field that while there can be persistence of the vector genomes in the targeted cells, that there is the potential, at least, and this has been improved upon over the years in terms of the inflammatory response to the vector itself, and that's certainly been the case with the work that the Duke group has had in improving those vectors, but there has not been an example like AAV in any other class of virus other than the retroviruses for persistence of expression. So that's something that distinguishes, I think, the approach using adenoviruses to AAV. So our feeling is that for something like an inherited disease, which is going to have a lifelong manifestation, that we should use an approach to gene transfer which is most likely to be persistent and lead to the least inflammatory response. Now, the question then is why muscle-specific gene therapy as opposed to secretion from the liver. I think the liver has several advantages, as does the muscle. So there is ideally one could utilize both platforms to achieve a correction. The focusing only on liver is very much like the protein transfer studies that are ongoing. And we have seen in our own lab the same consequences of infused protein and antibody production against the protein. When the protein is made within the cell, which needs that that protein to traffic properly to the lysosome, the interference of antibodies does not occur within a cell itself. So although there's potential for antibodies to help eliminate cells that are damaged and expose their inside to the circulation, a cell that's functioning properly that has cell-specific genetic correction is actually, we found, responds quite well to that approach. So that would be part of the rationale for treating muscle directly and to circumvent or lessen the antibody responses.
Well, I have one other question. What needs to happen for this to enter clinical trials? What is the major hurdle that you're...
So the steps required to proceed through the early proof of concept studies to have a discussion with the FDA about a clinical proposal and then to actually execute that clinical proposal. First of all, require that we choose a single agent for study. We always seem to be making slight improvements in the construct that expresses the gene, and I think we finally selected one that meets all our requirements for the best available to us now, and then selecting the way in which it would be delivered and at the doses that would be delivered. It's sometimes a little difficult to predict how the doses in mice would translate to bigger folks. But once that is established, which I think we have established, one then in working with the FDA establishes a plan for a clinical study and for the safety studies that are required. We're fortunate at our center that we have been designated as one of five sites in the country that is supported by the National Center for Research Resources, part of the NIH core group that provides funding the clinical research centers and a program called the National Gene Vector Laboratories. NGVL supports this small group of labs for vector production that and toxicologic studies, and our site is a toxicology center for NGVL, so we expect to utilize that mechanism to get funding to proceed with the studies. That's the next ingredient. Besides the time required to get all the work teed up, it's providing the funding to do that. And so that's the stage we're at. The NGVL also provides funding required to make clinical-grade material for an approved clinical plan. And that would be the very next step. After getting the toxicology studies completed, which we've done now for three different programs, both in muscle diseases and eye diseases, then we get the permission through our institution to do the clinical study. So,
question. Dr. Malfitano said he was at a pretty close to a critical threshold of toxicity for the doses that's required.
Right.
Are you having that same problem with your approach?
We've not found that yet. In the toxicology studies we've done for the existing trials, we use a safety margin of 10 times the top dose in the study to see whether we can generate toxicities related to the vector itself. And those studies actually involve what we attempt to do is make a worst-case scenario of giving the vector instead of just into muscle. We can make one group of animals receive the dose in the vein so that it theoretically goes everywhere. We haven't identified systemic toxicities related to that other than one example which was presented at the meeting which supervises these studies called the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee meeting. When we presented that data a few months ago, one of the questions that's come up is, what is the consequence of getting the vector everywhere in the body in such a way that that in males or in females there would be positivity of the vector in germ cells or gonadal tissue, so that would be eggs or sperm. Those studies are most easily conducted by looking at the contamination of the sperm by the DNA. That's something that the FDA would not want to allow unless this risk was justified by a certain benefit. We've done those studies with several types of AAV and actually are conducting a large longitudinal study that will look at several generations of animals to see whether having the vector in that fluid results in the gene being transferred from one generation to the next. We've actually never been able to demonstrate that, but we need to prove that conclusively to the FDA. So that's the only toxicity we've observed in it has never resulted in any adverse effects that we can find. So we'll keep looking. One of the challenges I'll mention in, I think, something that the part of the group here has done very well is meet the challenges of clinical manufacturing. So in order to reach a dose that will actually matter, we have to be able to make enough of this material, and that's something that we've devoted a lot of effort to. And in the Pompe's example, we'll actually be using a new manufacturing method that was developed just for the purpose of making more vector in an economical fashion. So,
thanks, Dr. Byrne.
Sure.
Kurt, can you talk a little bit about down the line what therapy would be like? Is this a once a year? Is it a once a month? How do you see that process occurring, and is it with ERT also?
Yeah, that's a good question. All the studies we've done thus far with gene transfer of AAV have been single-dose experiments. We generally find whether it's given IM or IV,
or into the liver, or the eye studies are given into the subretinal space. And there's even a group here studying Parkinson's disease, in which the gene transfer is done in the appropriate region of the brain. It's a single dose. We found that in cells that don't divide, like the brain, the muscle, and the eye, that it's not necessary to give another dose of material to get any sustained expression. So, you know, depending on the clinical trial design, there would be a single administration and then following over time. I can give you an idea of what's done in the Alpha-1 study. Is these patients are on prolactin when they qualify for the study. They are on a brief period in which the prolactin is withdrawn during the dosing, and then they go back on prolactin as needed by the clinical requirements of their regular physician, or their prolactin is actually still in a post-marketing study. It's not a fully approved therapy, but that's the study design which might be appropriate in this setting as well.
Theoretically, it could be a one-shot deal then.
Correct. That's what our expectation is.
Hey, Dr. Byrne, this is George Fox. I have a question for you. My question is, as far as the funding, do you see any problems with funding down the road for the studies that you have, and are you well enough funded?
But for many of the rare diseases, we really rely on the cooperation of the various organizations, as well as the rare disease entity within the NIH and the FDA, and there are funding mechanisms for those studies, and then specific agencies within the NIH that have an interest, like in pediatric diseases, it's the Child Health Agency. The Heart, Lung, Blood Institute has been supporting our work for a number of years because of the focus of this approach on heart disease. Traditionally, the muscular dystrophies have been supported in two other agencies, NIAMS and NINDS, Neurologic Diseases and Stroke Group, and that's where a lot of the work for the other dystrophies occurs. Not to mention that the MDA has been supportive in the initial part of this work and has had a very intense focus of gene transfer for muscular dystrophies, both limb-girdle and Duchenne's muscular dystrophy.
Okay, so you see that as far as funding goes, it's not really blocking your findings as far as you going forward with a clinical trial. Do you see anything as far as a certain avenue you want to approach, or a certain type of virus that you like, that you want to use, and can you see it implementing it in a clinical trial in the future? And if so, how long? What type of time frame do you think you'd be able to implement something?
The clinical studies that have been done thus far with AAV have had a good safety profile. So as long as we design studies which help answer some of the basic questions that are, you know, good science, then we expect that the NIH will get behind those. They've continued to be supportive of gene transfer studies in general, and this has been the focus, really, of a lot of different review groups within the NIH, and there's considerable expertise in that. So, no, the funding for this approach can utilize both public and private sources, and it's a fairly expensive proposition, even just to test the safety studies that are required by the FDA. So, you know, we need to utilize all the resources that are out there. But I think the good news for rare disease organizations is that the voice of those organizations has been heard, both in Congress and at the NIH, who listens very carefully to the appropriations committee that decides their funding level. So efforts by the MDA and other rare disease organizations, and NORD in particular, has I think, been heard. We see a lot of initiatives coming out of the NIH soliciting proposals related to rare diseases, and I think that's a good thing.
Right. So you're saying that positive findings in gene transfer with other diseases could help Pompe and Pompe-specific diseases?
Oh, absolutely. And by the same token, entities that are interested in more common diseases like heart failure will be interested and are interested in the findings from rare disease programs. The advantage in the rare disease studies is that we know this very specific pathophysiology of the disease, we hope. In some of the more complex multifactorial diseases that affect millions of people, like heart failure, it's unclear exactly what the best therapeutic approach is. And we know in single gene defects what to go after.
Right. Would you say Pompe is more specific or generalized?
No, very specific.
Right, okay. Okay, thank you, Dr. Burns.
Is there the possibility of getting a private corporation involved in helping to fund a clinical trial for Pompe, or is it such a rare disease that it would be difficult to find a company that would be interested?
No, one never rules out that possibility. There have been various companies that have expressed an interest both in lysosomal storage diseases and in cardiovascular disease that would theoretically use this as an example, if you will.
Like gene therapy.
The economics of it all are very complicated. I don't begin to understand what would make something a successful commercial venture, but I think the science behind it has to be the first motivator. And particularly the fact that we continue to look for successful therapeutic approaches for what is a complex problem.
From a corporate perspective, it would seem like they would be more interested in ERT, since it's a lifelong drug that would be required your entire life as opposed to gene therapy.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point, that in general, a pharmaceutical model is that treatments are something that generate more revenue than cures. And I wouldn't characterize the gene therapy necessarily as a cure, but if it's a one-time treatment, it's hard to imagine what the model for that is. And so it hasn't been established yet, but that made simply because it hasn't been successful yet. And so I think when there is a motivation to figure that out, there are plenty of smart people who can figure that out.
Dr. Byrne, this is Stephanie from California. As I understand what you're saying is that the gene therapy would be administered most likely by an injection into the muscle.
The study that we're doing now is establishing the safety of an injection into muscle. Our belief is that in the more severe examples of Pompe disease, that we have multiple muscles that are affected.
That was going to be my question.
So, therefore, we really want an approach that is more systemic in nature. And there are various strategies for achieving that. Actually, it's a very nice publication recently by Dr. Chamberlain's group focusing on Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, in which they use the strategy of AAV, gene transfer to muscle, but take advantage of a unique feature of a protein called VEGF, which helps get the vector beyond the vasculature into the muscle cells. In other types of AAV, not the type used in that study, the vector seems to do that a bit all on its own. So that's the approach that we're contemplating will be most useful in Pompe's disease.
Okay.
You know, and in conditions where there's only heart muscle involvement, there are other strategies for delivering just to the heart muscle or to the diaphragm or specific muscle groups that might be most affected. But I think the one approach is to consider trying to get all the muscles at once.
Mm.
I wasn't going to ask this, but I was talking about it. VEGF, do you think there's any role for VEGF in increasing permeability of the vasculature to make the enzyme more accessible to muscle?
For the protein. It's an interesting feature of vascular supply to muscle, which I think is underappreciated, even in the current study. Just like in the brain, muscle cells have the ability to what's known as auto-regulate their blood flow. And in general, only about 20% of a muscle is exposed to the cardiac output to that extremity. And that's so that we have the capacity to increase the blood flow to given muscle groups when needed. And I don't know that the problem is really at the level of escaping the capillary, where there's a very, for a protein the size of GAA, reasonable way to get to the muscle cell membrane. I think the issue that's an interesting one to address is how do we achieve the uniform distribution of the blood flow in an extremity? And there are some different strategies for doing that. I don't think VEGF would be the necessary or the way to go.
So they have data that shows that the vasculature is quite permeable to GAA?
Yes. I can't say that has been rigorously examined at the level of the capillary, but certainly at least in the transit of a given dose into the musculature, there seems to be plenty of receptor for it. There are some ideas about the ability of different muscle cell types to handle that protein differently, but in general, I think the block is more proximal than the capillary, but may involve how the cell itself, once it takes up the protein, deals with it.
How much of the GAA gets mopped up by presumably mannose-6-phosphate receptors?
Well, even mannose receptors will facilitate binding of the protein, and so there's some nonspecificity there. And one thing we, I think, are trying to understand in our own lab is what happens to the protein when it's complexed with an antibody which is bound to it. And that becomes a much bigger complex than the protein alone. And that may certainly influence the ability to leave the vessel and get to the muscle cell membrane, where presumably, even if the antibody went with the protein into the cell, they would separate and go their way, separate ways to the lysosome and for the antibody to be degraded. But it's that's something that's really unknown right now.
Dr. Byrne?
Yes.
My name is Christine Mockel. I'm from New Jersey. I have late onset Pompe's disease. I was just diagnosed a year ago. I was just curious. I was reading today about the myostatin blockers with the mighty mice, that they were seeing that it was making them much stronger.
Right.
For somebody like me who's just beginning to have difficulty with walking, would something like that possibly be beneficial to someone like me, to have something that maybe could work with the muscles that I have, making them a little stronger?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept for those that don't haven't followed this. I can give you a smidge of background. This protein myostatin is part of a family of proteins that regulate how different organs grow to a certain size. So muscle mass is controlled by the level of myostatin expression, and it's a influences it in reverse, if you will. More myostatin makes you smaller, and less myostatin makes more muscle. And for some of the diseases where there's an abnormal loss of cells, it may be that things like myostatin help the dividing myoblasts, which make more muscle cells, to become myotubes or mature muscle cells. In the case of acid maltase deficiency, those cells would probably be equally affected by the glycogen accumulation. So it wouldn't necessarily be a long-term benefit, and actually would probably promote using the precursor cells at a faster rate than one might want. So I don't think that's probably a good strategy, but it's a very interesting approach to some of the other dystrophies, or particularly those people without inherent muscle disease but have muscle wasting for various reasons, whether it be infection or age or immobilization due to a broken leg. So there are a lot of ideas about how that might help people, but I think it's probably not a very interesting scientific problem to address muscle mass. It probably is not going to be helpful in acid maltase deficiency.
10-minute warning.
Hey, Dr. Byrne, a moment ago you spoke of the infused, the RHGAA protein being complexed with an antibody and it sort of regulating its uptake in the muscle. What percentage would you say of the RHGAA protein during infusion or even shortly after infusion has antibodies attached to it? Would it be all of them, or do you think some of them miss?
The immune system has a tremendous capacity for response to foreign protein. So, in theory, the amount of protein that's infused, even though it's a huge amount, actually, there are many cells waiting to make more antibody when needed. No one's ever analyzed what portion of protein behaves in which way, because it, with or without the antibody, because it, for one, it actually, with or without the antibody, rapidly leaves the circulation. And so those studies haven't been done in humans. We've attempted to analyze some of those questions in mice, but their immune system and their response to this protein when it's a human protein are going to be quite different than individuals with which are getting infused protein. So I'm not sure we have an answer to that question, but I think it's an important area that needs more work.
Right. Right. How long do you think the RHGAA protein stays in the system, as far as if you were to take a blood draw right after infusion and a blood draw, you know, every subsequent 12 hours, do you think, when would you come up with the blood that had no RHGAA?
Yeah, in the mice that transits pretty rapidly out of the circulation into the lysosome or another compartment where it's not accessible to the blood, that study in humans is being done as part of the current enzyme replacement therapy trial, both in 1602 and 1702, as they're called. And so we have, as investigators, have not seen that data yet. Hopefully, that information will be shared when we try to sort through the results of the two studies.
Thanks.
So, yeah, Genzyme has that information right now.
Okay.
We've got about 5 minutes, Dr. Burns.
Dr. Burns, there was an incident a couple of years ago up at Penn where a subject died and was getting gene replacement therapy. Yep. You know, that set the whole process back. Is that old news? Has the industry wouldn't move past that? Or?
Yeah, I think helped the community at large focus on safety issues. That study was being done with an adenovirus that was being delivered to the liver specifically, and I think we've learned some of the dose-limiting toxicities, as you've heard about in the previous conferences, the potential for adverse reactions in the liver. And I think we've learned a lot about how to do better preclinical safety studies. And as I said, we hope that we can design safe studies, because that event did impact on the field. But I think in the end, we, with the help of the FDA and the NIH RAC, have been more careful at designing safe studies. So in the long run, I think we'll get closer to viable therapies as a result of that. And that group has done some fabulous work in the interim, both on the reasons behind that problem that occurred, as well as really studying more extensively these other vectors, AAV, the kind of related but distant cousins to the adenovirus used in that study, to find these new vectors which are very potent in muscle and liver.
Where does your virus, the virus you're using, go if injected IV? Does it also tend to go to the liver?
It goes to the liver, and a very wide distribution to the liver and to the muscle cells, particularly the heart and skeletal muscle. We've
those
not seen much in the smooth muscle cells, but or in the central nervous system, but particularly in the systemically in skeletal muscle, which is really what we want. And it wouldn't be a detriment, we hope, to have some secreted from the liver as well. What we're really interested in avoiding is any, if we can keep the virus from making protein in immune cells, which would facilitate the antibody again, and to try to avoid the vigorous immune response.
It's been about an hour. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can answer questions as long as people have them.
I just had one other question. I was just thinking about it. But what about the blood-brain barrier, Dr. Byrne? I never actually asked you about that. And your virus, is there any correlation there, or can the virus pass through the blood-brain barrier?
Well, that's an interesting question. The barrier that you're talking about really protects the brain, but there's another interesting question to be raised in Pompe's disease. We know that in parts of the spinal cord and in the peripheral motor neurons, there is extensive glycogen accumulation. And one of the questions we've been trying to address is whether we've effectively, whether it's by protein or gene transfer, treated the peripheral musculature. But we know that the protein doesn't penetrate into the peripheral nerves or the central nervous system very effectively. And the possibility exists that there is a neuropathy that's part of this disease that hasn't been well characterized. And that would also really manifest itself as weakness, even though the muscle may be improved if it had a more effective motor neuron stimulating it. So one area of research that some of the people interested in ALS and other spinal cord diseases have begun to look at is the finding that several groups have had now, that AV injected into muscle is able to jump across that that interface between the nerve and the muscle and actually travel into the motor neuron. And the nucleus for that cell is back in the spinal cord and rest there to make protein, which influences the nerve as well. So that's aside from the immunology questions that are out there to be answered, understanding the neurological components of the disease are one of the next things we really need to focus on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because you're saying that the RHDAA wouldn't reach nearly as far. It wouldn't reach that barrier.
No, in general, that hasn't been observed. But
right. But the your gene or the virus, the AAV virus, could.
It has in a example of ALS. We've not only tested that superficially in the work we're doing, but that's certainly another area that needs further study.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, we had imagined at one time to be a pretty straightforward thing of one missing protein and one gene to deal with it, has, as you all appreciate, been more complex, both in the enzyme replacement therapies and in the gene transfer strategy. But we're going to keep trying to unravel these questions and try to get answers.
Right.
Okay, Marcia, it sounds like they're all questioned out.
Thank you so much. It was so interesting. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, all right. Glad to participate.
Thank you so much,
Dr. Burns.
All right, bye now.
Bye. Bye. Am I the last one?
Do they know if you're on?
They can hear us.
Hello?
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.